ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australians across regional and remote parts of the country have their weather routines. It might be checking a physical rain gauge in the morning or looking at the clouds. But jumping on the Bureau of Meteorology's website is definitely high on the list. I know I check it constantly. If you're a regular user, you'll have noticed things have changed. A lot. And many farmers in regional Victoria aren't happy.
This time of year vital for anyone doing hay or silage, but depending where they are in the state, and also from an animal point of view, if people have been shearing, so they have been shearing and or lambing, there's obvious weather outlooks on that that are really critical if you can do things to support the animal's health and welfare during those times. So really important to be able to access that kind of data that the Bureau provides.
You'll hear more on those changes shortly. And if you live in North Australia and like to exercise, you'll know you have to get up early in the summer months.
You can't avoid the sun, which is not good for people of my skin complexion.
Climate adaptation is proving harder at the top of the country. I'm Alex Barwick, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Mbantua, Alice Springs, bringing you stories from across regional and remote parts of the country. The Bureau of Meteorology's website is visited by millions of Australians every day. You may well be one of them. Some are just looking for the daily forecast. But for those in rural and regional Australia, say in farming, mining, those out on the water or in remote communities, it's a vital tool that influences business and community life. So when changes are made to the BOM's website, it's a big deal. As wild weather spreads across Victoria, and with some farmers receiving their best rain this spring, many people logged on to one of their most important business tools to find everything had changed this week. A major upgrade to the Bureau of Meteorology's website was launched at the same time as some serious hot weather arrived, a key time for farming businesses, and overwhelmingly, the feedback has been negative. And that's right across the country. It's been pretty harsh, as text messages to the ABC's various state-based editions of the Country Hour attest. Things like this have been sent in. The new BOM site is unbelievably useless. Not happy BOM. BOM site is garbage and completely not useful anymore. After pressing 20 different options, I've given up and hit my phone with a hammer. Warwick Long presents the Country Hour in Victoria and is with me this afternoon. Warwick, this just doesn't seem to be working for people, does it?
No, certainly not. And it was a change that hit quickly and at a time when wild weather and winds and various different difficult experiences were hitting farming communities. And at that time, when people were going to one of their most trusted sources to get the information they need to make decisions, they were left incredibly frustrated. And those messages that you just read out attest to that. There is a lot of anger in rural and regional Australia today.
So what sort of feedback have you received? What specifically are the changes that everyday users are particularly unhappy with?
Yeah, so for a lot of people, a Bureau of Meteorology website is literally to find out how hot or how cold it's going to be for a day. Do I need to take a brolly with me on my commute to work? For certain industries like farming, the Bureau's website is hugely important because decisions are being made that are worth hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to various farming businesses all the time, minute by minute. And that is being done by judging things like wind speed, judging things like when rain and fronts are going to arrive, if they're going to arrive, where you should put things like where you should put your sheep after they've been shorn so that they don't die. It can be an animal welfare issue. It can be a use of sprays and chemicals on farms issue. It can be a using fertilizer issue. It affects everything of the daily lives of these businesses, and it's big money and it's big time, and the website upgrade left farmers frustrated in trying to find the finite information, the really important information that they're using to make these decisions. So there was a broad view on the website when you log on that you can see the temperatures and the weather conditions for that day, but that important information, that's become so much harder to find, and that's why farmers are angry. And Stuart Barber, a farmer at Benalla, he farms sheep. He is one of those farmers that was pretty excited by the idea of a bureau upgrade to its website. He thought there were some things that could be made easier, but he was left ultimately frustrated and spending hours when he didn't have the time.
Yeah, I'm a relatively regular user of the bureau's services, and in general, that information is really, really good. But it was just considerably harder to find and or unfindable. Some parts of information were really well displayed. So the stuff going forward for the next 4 or 5 days looks great. So well done on that front. So it's a positive on that bit. But to be honest, the bulk of things were clunkier and harder to find. And if you could find them, they were a lot more clicks and effort to find them. So I don't know how much testing had been done with rural users. So it might look quite nice from a metropolitan point of view, but from a rural user's point of view, not as functional as the old setup.
Stuart Barber there from Benalla. Warwick, what's the Bureau had to say about this upgrade? Because they must be aware that there's backlash already.
The Bureau says this is what their users wanted. They wanted a change to the website and they wanted it to be much more user-friendly. So they thought there'll be some people angry because they don't like change. That was the excuse basically given by one of the Bureau spokespeople to the Country Hour earlier today. But ultimately, this change is what people wanted. Here's Miriam Bradbury, who's a meteorologist with the Bureau of Meteorology, having a chat to South Australian Country Hour presenter Cassie Huff.
It was quite outdated. We were getting a lot of feedback from the Australian community explaining ways that it could be improved, commenting that it was looking quite tired. So this refresh has been a long time in the making, a long time in the planning, and hopefully it'll bring our website into 2025 looking much more modern, much more sleek, and it's got a couple of new features too. But I guess the main thing to sort of remember is that all of the information, the forecasts and warnings that you were accessing on the Bureau's old site, they're still available on the new site. It's just a probably slightly different click to get there.
It's not getting a lot of love. Are you concerned about the reaction that has been generated by people who are commenting on it?
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, this change to the website was something that the public requested. So we know that the majority of people who are using this website are going to be looking favourably on a modernisation, a sleeker site, something that has more features. But certainly we understand that it is really sort of confronting when something that potentially you use every day to, you know, work out what your day looks like, what your week looks like, it suddenly changes everything. So we do appreciate that there is a lot of, concerns about using this site in the future. We really just encourage you to explore it, have some fun, look at the new things that you can find on this site. And, by all means, leave us some feedback. If you do have some particular comments you want to pass on, you can find a little black feedback box on the right-hand side of the page. If you click on that, you can submit some feedback to our development teams there, and that'll definitely be noted down.
Miriam Bradbury there from the Bureau. Warwick, so the Bureau is taking feedback on this. Do you sense that this new site might be refined and tweaked based on all the feedback flowing through?
This has been one of the frustrations from farmers. They say when they've gone to give feedback to the Bureau, it's been actually hard to find a place to do that. And when they've tried to log that feedback, they've got messages saying feedback isn't being received at this time. There's been a phone number many farmers have rung. That hasn't worked either. They're unsure if the Bureau's listening to them. And they're saying this is a change that's affecting their lives, affecting their livelihood, affecting how much time they're spending on this website to try and navigate their way around it. And ultimately, even volunteer fire brigades, which are the backbone of Victoria, which has some of the worst fire seasons in the world, they're worried that their ease of being able to access information and on things like wind speeds and clouds and how fronts are moving could ultimately affect their ability to save lives. So there's a lot at stake here.
And closer to home, as the nation's emergency broadcaster and a place that people come to for clear information about what's happening in their patch, a lot of ABC staff across the country will be logging onto the bomb site each day. Have you had a play yourself, and what did you make of the update?
Yeah, so this has been one of the interesting things inside the ABC. I think more people have wanted to talk to me about this change than almost even outside. But that's except for the farming community. They're certainly irate about this. I've had a play around and I can see some of the frustrations. Being able to access radar sites at a distance that is meaningful for your business. You used to be able to just hit, for me, the Yarrawonga Raider, 256 kilometres. That gave me a great insight into a distance away from my house of how clouds were moving and whether and when rain was likely to hit my house. That's now harder for somebody to find on the website. You can get there, it's hard. Things like the MetEye, which is wind speeds, that's hard to find. So you can get that frustration too. But ABC listeners are great because they've been in contact with us at the Country Hour. The old website at the moment for the Bureau is still up online, right? So I've found a way, if you put in REG before you put .bomb.gov.au, that takes you to the old website rather than the new website. So I've found myself even going back to the old one to navigate it all around, but I don't know how long that's going to stay for.
Warwick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Warwick Long there, who's found a cheeky workaround and who presents the Country Hour in Victoria. My name's Alex Barwick. You're listening to Australia Wide. We head to my part of the country, Central Australia, next.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
I eat corn sometimes and my mum cooks it in the oven.
Well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man.
ABC Australia Wide.
Because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains. And when it's not raining, it's raining more.
On ABC Radio.
The family of Kumanjai White and friends have gathered outside the Alice Springs Coroner's Court. The death of the young Walpri man from Yundamu, who lived with a disability, sparked protests across the country. He died in police custody in May of this year after being restrained by off-duty police officers in Coles supermarket in Alice Springs. Reporter Elsie Lang was at the court. Elsie, thanks for speaking to Australia Wide. What's unfolded in the coroner's court?
In a hearing at the coroner's court, Coroner Elizabeth Armitage heard from interested parties, those people who will be a part of the inquest going forward. She laid out a little bit of a timeline and said also that there isn't one yet because she hasn't received a full brief of evidence as the criminal investigations are ongoing.
And what else did she say in the court today?
She spoke to Kumanjai White's family. She said she was sorry to see them in such terrible circumstances again. She was the coroner who handed down the findings about Kumanjai Walker in June this year.
And who else could you see in the coroner's court?
In the coroner's court were members of Kumanjai White's family, Ned Hargraves, alongside his mother, his stepfather and his little brother. He also had another father in the room and one of his cousins. In the room, over video link, we had Peggy Dwyer, the counsel assisting. George Newhouse is the lawyer representing Kumanjai White's family. We also saw representatives from Coles Supermarkets, Talis Security, Life Without Barriers, who were the carers for Kumanjai White, as well as the high-profile lawyer Luke Officer, who's representing one of the officers involved in the case, Sergeant Stephen Haig.
And so do we know exactly who we'll hear from when we come to the actual inquest?
We still don't have those details yet. I'm guessing we will hear from Coles Supermarkets and we will hear from Life Without Barriers, but we still don't have those details.
And we know there was a group that had gathered outside of the court. Who was there?
Outside of the court this morning, we saw Ned Jumpajimba Hargraves, as I said, Kumanjai White's grandfather, his mother, father and little brother, but also members of the community who responded to a media statement put out by Kumanjai White's lawyer, George Newhouse, and the family yesterday afternoon, just saying that they would be there speaking to the media, talking about how they are upset at how long this process has taken. It's been 5 months since Kumanjai White died in the Coles supermarket. Let's hear a little bit of what Ned Jumpajimba Hargraves has to say.
We want to get to the point and finish up. We can't keep on like this. It's not right. We are angry. We are frustrated. So we need answers.
That's Ned Jumpajimba Hargraves, and of course the family is still calling for the CCTV footage of the incident to be released and for there to be an independent investigation.
Speaking of investigations, last month NT Police announced the autopsy and brief of evidence in their death in custody investigation had been completed. What's happened to those findings?
Police say the DPP will decide now whether there is enough evidence to lay charges against any of the officers involved in the incident as a result of that report.
Elsie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Alex.
Reporter Elsie Lang in Alice Springs, Mbantua.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Now to the Pilbara in WA. In the wake of increasingly dire climate change forecasts, cities and towns across the country are being asked to rapidly cool down urban environments. But experts are warning that climate adaptation, particularly in northern Australia, is struggling to keep up with the pace of climate change, and it's residents in remote towns and communities that are being hit hardest. Karratha reporter Charlie McLean has more.
Weekend park runs in northern WA start early to beat the heat. It's just gone 7:45 in the mining town of Karratha, and already it's 30 degrees. Some, like new arrivals Sam Scott and Charlie Gilbert, have started making adjustments.
Well, this guy actually had to shave his head because he wasn't dealing with the heat. So,
yeah, that was... I've shaved the head to make sure I'm very nice and temperature controlled for summer coming up. So yeah.
But Charlie Gilbert says there's really only so much individuals can do to adapt to rising temperatures.
Look around, there's no trees or any shade anywhere. So you can't avoid the sun, which is not good for people of my skin complexion.
For years, climate scientists have been urging communities to adapt to climate change by cooling down the built environment. But Australia's first climate risk assessment found there was an adaptation action shortfall across every part of the country. Karratha Mayor Dan Scott acknowledges the town can be uncomfortable.
I think we could do with more shade. You know, we have fair few trees within Karratha, but I think in the future what the city, what we're leaning towards as a local government is getting into producing more shade.
The extremes that define life in northern Australia are making the task of adapting more difficult. Effective climate mitigation is all about green and blue spaces. Plants, trees and water bodies are natural heat sinks, which remove heat from the environment, whereas the materials we typically build our urban areas out of, things like concrete and steel, only amplify heat. But both green and blue spaces need lots of water, which in semi-desert regions like the Pilbara is scarce. Further north in the tropics, there are other barriers to climate adaptation. Darwin lost hundreds of trees in Cyclone Marcus in 2018. The city's Environment Services Executive Manager Nick Fuster says it wiped out a lot of natural shade.
There was a huge reduction in trees. Of about 30% of our canopy cover was reduced. We're at around 35-36%, and it went down to 24%.
UNSW architecture professor Mateus Santamoris has modelled climate mitigation strategies in a variety of different regions. He says what works in Western Sydney won't necessarily work in Karratha and Darwin. In 2019, he worked on a project modelling the effect of different techniques in Alice Springs, an arid climate similar to Karratha. It found strategic shading and using cool, reflective building materials had a big impact.
What is important is that we have, tested these materials on the roof of low-income houses for the First Nation people in the area. The use of these materials decreases the peak temperature indoors by 10 degrees.
Climate projections for northern Australia make for frightening reading. Heat-related deaths in Darwin are tipped to rise by 110% by 2050, and that's under an optimistic 1.5-degree warming scenario. Dr. Santamoris describes the social cost of climate change as extremely high.
Suicide rate is increasing very much during the period of high temperatures.
But he takes comfort from the fact the most effective mitigation strategies are cheap and easy to implement.
Fortunately, we have the technology to do it. We know how to do it, and we've done it in several parts of the world, So we have the potential really to improve the quality of life of these people immediately, and with very low cost. In my opinion, this is number one priority.
That story from Karratha reporter Charlie McLean. We head to Queensland next.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Seven young female gymnasts have alleged bullying, including body shaming, humiliation and isolation from their coach at a local club in Queensland. When they and their families raised concerns, the club says it ran its own investigation and found none of the complaints against its coach or the club could be substantiated. The families then took their concerns further, raising them with Gymnastics Australia and Sports Integrity, who each referred the requests back to the club. Soon after, the squad of girls who raised complaints was disbanded, and each were told they could no longer train at the club. ABC reporter Owen Jarks has the story. Thanks for speaking to me, Owen.
Of course.
Owen, tell me about the girls you've spoken to.
Sure. So Alana Mason is 13, Talia Shields is 18. These are two very accomplished gymnasts who have performed and succeeded in regional, state and national competitions for a long, long time, and both have been at this local gymnastic club for most of their lives. Each have told me how they would head to their gym multiple nights a week for hours at a time as part of that dedication. But what changed was the arrival of a new coach late last year, and that's when the athletes I've spoken to say that dynamic changed for the seven girls on this particular squad, and that includes Alana and Talia.
So what did they tell you was happening at the club?
So they've both made complaints to me and to the club about the way this coach allegedly interacted with them. I should make clear, the club's position is that it has investigated these complaints made by these girls and others, and it found that they could not be substantiated. So for Alana, who again, she's 13 years old, she described how much she liked this new coach at first, then alleges they made some fairly concerning comments. We've got some audio from her now.
When the new coach came in, it was good at first, and then she just got like really like strict, but I thought it was like fun because it was just like she's harsher than the other coaches I had, but then she started like saying stuff that like wasn't like normal, I think. Like she'd say stuff that like I wouldn't never have heard from my old coach. Like she'd say that we were like bigger than the other girls, like we had more fat on us. So that was one of the things.
Alana's mum told me that soon after that they noticed that Alana was bringing home her school lunchboxes untouched and was now often reluctant to eat in front of other people. The second athlete who spoke to me was Talia Shields. So she's 18 and she's been in the sport for a long, long time as well, more than half her life. So she is used to really intense training as a gymnast. And she complained that with this new coach, she was left feeling isolated.
No coach I've ever had has made me feel the way she has. And it's not so much as in words, it's more actions, like ignoring me, like belittling me. Like I felt so worthless and useless in that, because I just thought I wasn't worth any of her time. And like, yeah, I just felt like, why am I here? Like she doesn't like me, like I'm not good. She made me lose all of my confidence. And so whereas my other coaches, they never really, they never really supported you or motivated you in a nice way, but they never made you feel like worthless and stupid.
Talia Shields speaking there. Owen, so these families and athletes made a series of complaints. What happened next?
That's right. So the families first went to the club itself, which launched its own internal investigation. According to the club, it spoke to many athletes, the coach involved, and others, but ultimately there was no further action taken. And the families say that their athletes, the ones who made complaints, weren't part of those who were spoken to. The girls' squad was moved back to their former coach, but the family said they were still so worried that they went up the chain to basically Gymnastics Australia and Sports Integrity, only to find that those groups essentially found the complaints should be handled by the club, and that's where things were left. But soon after, the girls got an email, and they were told that their squad was going to be disbanded. And not only that, the girls would no longer be offered any training. So now these girls who had been with this club for so long had nowhere to train. The club confirmed this but says the squad was disbanded due to a lack of resources and rejects any allegation that there was some sort of connection to these complaints. The families, however, were not convinced, and that's when some of them reached out to me.
And then what's happened since?
But what's come of this is that I've gone to Gymnastics Australia independently and to Sports Integrity and some others to find out what's happened and find out how this situation unfolded. Gymnastics Australia has eventually come back and said that while they did know of the complaint generally, they'd never heard any of these allegations of body shaming that Alana had made. So after we reached out to them, they then went to Alana's family for a meeting to hear those claims in detail from the source, from Alana. And since then, they've now announced that they've hired an independent investigator, and their job will essentially be to consider how this was handled the whole way along and make some suggestions and findings for Gymnastics Australia. The families are hopeful that something's going to come of it. It's too early really to say at this point, but for now, it is a wait-and-see situation.
Thanks, Owen.
Thank you, Alex.
Queensland-based reporter Owen Jarks with that story. And finally, the hunt for hidden treasure is under threat in Queensland. Recreational fossicking and gold prospectors in Claremont say a new law is endangering the pastime in the Sunshine State. The law allows mining lease applicants to kick hobbyists out of previously accessible areas before their mine is approved. Reporter Liam McNally has this story.
The central Queensland town of Claremont was built on the back of gold in the 1860s. Today, industrial mining is still one of the region's biggest industries, but hobby prospectors also flock to the area in the hopes of striking pay dirt. A recent law change, however, is stopping recreational prospectors in their tracks. Frida Berry-Porter has already seen the effects from her prospecting supplies store.
It's more than just the economic loss, it's that social benefit to Claremont as a town. Many were almost in tears thinking that they might not be coming back for next year for Claremont because it's too difficult to get onto some of these areas or it's removed from the available land.
Fossicking and prospecting in state forests in Queensland can only be conducted in general permission areas, or GPAs, which are granted by bodies with special interests in the public land. In June, the Mineral and Energy Resources and Other Legislation Amendment Act, also known as the Morolla Act, came into effect, which added pending mining lease applicants to the list of bodies with authority over GPAs. In the Blair Athol State Forest near Claremont, large swathes of GPAs are under pending applications, and Claremont's hobby prospectors say they're being kicked out.
There's no precedent for this anywhere in the country. This extra layer of permission that's required is causing a lot of confusion and concern and basically putting people off from coming to Claremont. It's already very hard to get onto land in Queensland, and this is just going to make it even harder. We don't know the extent of the impact will be because the price of gold is now getting quite high, some record prices, which increases the interest of people to go and peg mining leases. So we've got so many interested stakeholders in that land area, and just remembering state forest is public land.
The hunt for hidden treasure in Claremont's prospecting hub and the strong community around it inspired Clinton and Susan Lonergan to move to the region 4 years ago.
Oh, it means everything to me at the moment. I can go out on a daily basis here. It's great to meet people. I love the look of gold and taking people out and just talking and meeting people out there in the fields. It's just something different. I'm a bush boy by heart. Now I'm a bush man by heart. And fresh air, it's just unbelievable to me anyway. So, and the people you get to meet out here, they do it for the same reason.
But they've already been rejected access by one pending applicant, and they say if they can't pursue their passion, they'll have to think about moving on.
It's a bit upsetting for us. But there's lots of people that have said to us that have come here that they won't come back now. It is already having an impact.
Isaac Council Deputy Mayor Jane Pickles says fossickers like the Lonergans are the cornerstone of Claremont's visitor economy. She says Isaac Council intends to work with the state government to understand the full effects of the Morolla Act and how issues can be addressed.
Our tourism industry thrives on the thousands of visitors who travel here to experience the historic goldfields. Gold mining is a key part of Claremont's heritage and identity, so it really connects people with the town's history. And visitors form a really strong connection with many returning year after year. We do have some real concerns about those changes. Sometimes those applications go on for a number of years, so this is a long-term issue. I think the Act was intended to clarify permissions, but it really has some unintended consequences for regions like ours.
A Department of Natural Resources and Mines, Manufacturing and Regional and Rural Development spokesperson said in a statement the presence of a mining lease application does not invalidate a GPA. However, fossickers must obtain permission from the mining lease holder. The department works hard to balance the rights and interests of fossickers with other land uses and users across the state. Mining lease applicants invest heavily to identify and develop resources that deliver royalties to the state. Requiring fossickers to seek their permission balances recreational fossicking with the rights of commercial miners, it said. Back in her Claremont store, Frida Berry-Porter says she'd like to see Queensland move to a system she said is already working in other states.
If we just simplified it so under the fossicking licence, those areas were available to us, so state forests, stock route, council reserves, where historic goldfields exist. So look to other states where it works well. New South Wales and Victoria have that wider public access to state forest. It'd be great if the foster-seeking licence included that under the given areas of where we can go to detect without needing this permission process, which is very hard to establish and very easy to lose.
Owner of the Outback Prospector in Clermont, Frieda Berry-Porter, ending that story from Liam McNally. And that's Australia Wide for today. My name's Alex Barwick. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen.